Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading some interesting articles from the October 2021 issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. The River Flows. If Marlon Rotek and Don Weller learned anything putting together the book and exhibition The River Flows, it's that you have to go with the flow. The two artists met and became fast friends in 2011 when their paintings were on view in the Western Art Show at Cheyenne Frontier Days. What started out with a handshake and a rodeo's photo pit has blossomed in so many ways, says Weller. We were both painting cowboys in watercolor, but Marlon is very photorealistic, and I'm very loose and fluid. We're kind of the two extremes in the way people use watercolors. Same subject, polar opposite styles. That seemed like the basis for an interesting two-man show of our own work. While planning that exhibition, December 14th to April 24th, at the Northeastern Nevada Museum in Elko, the duo began hatching another, even grander, groundbreaking project, a museum exhibition accompanied by a book that would explore Western history and Western art history all in one. The show would blend historical watercolors depicting the West with works by today's top contemporary Western watercolorists. Nothing like it had ever been done. But Weller and Rotak soon quickly discovered that there were stringent conditions and prohibitive expenses for transporting, storing, insuring, and displaying the antique paintings, and that reconciling conflicting requirements from various museums presented an insurmountable snag. They would have to forfeit the idea of borrowing historical pieces and instead focus on creating a museum-quality book and recruiting living artists for the exhibition. Their efforts culminated in the recently published book, The River Flows, and an exhibition and sale by the same name, which will be on view October 2, 2021, to February 6, 2022, at the Phippen Museum. Don and I are so immersed in watercolor that it's all we think about, Rotak says. In this book and show, we tried to cover all the aspects. Works in watercolor are very collectible, and they last forever. Paintings from the 1500s are still as bright as ever. On the contemporary side, so many different accomplished artists are represented. They come at it from different directions, but what we all have in common is love of country and love of this medium. We talked with Weller and Rotak about the book, the exhibition, and the importance of watercolors in the West. Congrats on The River Flows. It was a long time in the making. Rotak, when we first started to think about this project, we imagined an exhibition with the classic deceased artists' paintings hanging right next to today's contemporary masters. There would be an exhibition catalog to accompany the show. I began discussing our idea with over a dozen of the country's most respected Western museums. After a few months, it became quite clear that such an exhibition was not feasible. Each institution had their own unique demands for heat control, types of lighting, insurance, and packing and transporting regulations. A nightmare. Sadly, I had to inform Don. He, too, was disappointed, but he said, "Let's just think on it a bit." 2 days later, he called excitedly. We would shift the focus from an exhibition to an elegant book featuring watercolors of the American West, both then and now. Surprisingly, a concept that had never been done. The book would be able to show multitudes more work by both historic and contemporary artists. Then, after the book's publication, an exhibition and sale of the 14 living artists' work could be held at a well-known Western museum, rewarding both the contributing artists and also potential Western art collectors. And now the heavy lifting is over? Rotec, being an artist is such a solitary thing. Don and I had so many hurdles to jump, but we figured out how to clear them and make the project even better. We talked every day for 2 years, and it was always positive. We always were in agreement. We could understand each other's vision. It wasn't until we were completely done that it dawned on me that this was what it must have been like in Abbey Road Studios. We were simpatico, like Lennon and McCartney. All of this happened while I was blind in my right eye and couldn't paint. It gave me a creative outlook. It was just a ball. If it's one of the highest achievements of my life. Tell us a little about the long and important role of watercolors in the West. Rotec. The earliest paintings in the book and exhibit were done when the first European explorers journeyed through the West and discovered new places and Native Americans. These early paintings show Native people who look far different than the Hollywood version. These portraits are stunning and an education. The early explorers often took artists with them, since cameras were not yet invented, and the artists used watercolor because it was lighter and faster than oils. And that is how a pictorial history of the West was recorded. These are paintings that touch the heart and imagination, but also tell of the continuing passage of time. And it is this continuing passage of time, the cycle and flow of lives and cultures, of people and experiences, that is told through the movement of water and paint on paper. Who are a couple of those early artists whose names or works we would recognize? The historic artists in the book are not only fascinating for their creations, but their lives were equally interesting. Carl Bodmer and Alfred Jacob Miller, both skilled professional artists, accompanied very early expeditions into the West with an artistic approach to scientific recording. Their landscapes, as well as images of Native Americans, are still reference material for Hollywood in such movies as A Man Called Horse, Little Big Man, and Dances with Wolves. As the West evolved, the artists continued to reflect these changes. Later on, such artists as Frederick Remington and Charlie Russell gave us the reality of the cowhand and the Plains Indians. Thomas Moran exposed the world to the fantastic landscapes of the American West and, in effect, was a motivating force for the establishment of the national park system. The book and its flow layout are intended to give the reader a visual history of the opening and taming of the West, as well as demonstrating the beauty of the living West in the contemporary works. We wanted to expose a wide variety of artists and with brief glimpses into their lives to stimulate the reader for further individual research. We selected watercolors that deliver a sense of optimism, freedom, and pride that is inherently American. On the historical side, you've got two centuries of American watercolors revealing through differing artists, each with his own distinctive style and experience, the exploration and magnificence of the American West. Who are some of the contemporary artists we might recognize, and why should we care? Weller. Watercolor brings out the quirks and personality of the artist in a way not often seen in other museums. In capable hands, there is a freshness, luminosity, and joy that transcend the subject matter. To hang a show of this caliber that is exclusively watercolor is truly unique. The 14 artists have been enthusiastic about this project from the first phone call, and that should set the tone for a great opening weekend. For me, to name a favorite is impossible and politically incorrect. However, I will mention that I walked into a gallery in Santa Fe and saw some Tom Perkinson landscapes that were beautiful and huge. Where in the world does he get paper that big? So amazing, I had to go back several times. Also, long ago, living on cement surrounded by palm trees, I saw a watercolor painting of a Great Basin cowboy that took me to a West I thought I'd lost somewhere. It was a watercolor by William Matthews. Morton Solberg's paintings look like abstract expressionism, but look again. What looks frisky is genius. How did he do that? Do you admire craftsmanship? Our group includes Dean Mitchell, Marlon Rotak, and more. It's a rich, diverse group, and we are proud of everyone. How about the historic artists? Any favorites? Rotak. I have a number of favorite paintings in the book, but two deceased artists' works I find special are Bodmer's Mato Tope, a Mandan chief, and Russell's Powder River, Letter Buck. Bodmer's is such a beautifully depicted portrait of a tribal leader who, like most of his people, would soon die from international exposure by whites to smallpox. A lasting, wonderful tribute to a magnificent, sharing man. Russell's is wonderful just for the sheer energy of the scene. It doesn't get more powerful or cowboy than that. Among contemporary artists, there are just too many admirable masterpieces to make a selection. I must say that my partner in this venture, Don Weller, is for me king of the cowboy watercolors, and I consider him an artistic genius. I've spent many enjoyable hours with the book, learning a ton from the text and immersing myself in the amazing images. Do you think people really realize the historic nature of the medium? Rotak. We wanted to demonstrate that the medium has proven itself through time, as stable as oils, and has been the chosen means of expression in limitless approaches. It historically brought the images of the new continent to life and led to the evolution of America as a country. We also wanted to give readers a taste of the artists' fascinating lives in hopes that they would be compelled and rewarded by further research on their own. Finally, regarding the contemporary works in the upcoming exhibition at the FIPIN, is there anything you'd single out? Rotak. It's tough to give a don't-miss pick. Most exhibitions show a few pieces by an artist. However, The River Flows will display large bodies of work by each artist hung within ample space. Because of this, viewers will be able to immerse themselves in images that, in effect, create an environment of that specific artist's vision. It is a landmark exhibition because it is the first totally dedicated to the West portrayed in the watercolor medium. The exhibition and the book are not the end of the subject by any means, but rather a beginning. And so, the river continues to flow. Ranch of Ages. Deep in California's Santa Ynez wine country, the timeless Alisal Guest Ranch and Resort, celebrating its 75th anniversary this year, is treasured by generations of families and a couple of memory-making escapists. By Jordan Rain. Once we roll past the ostrich farm, we're getting pretty close. As we drive through Buellton, a small gateway town into California's famed Santa Ynez Valley, a flock of monster-sized birds collectively glares in our general direction from the tourist bait grounds of Ostrich Land, USA, like an imported welcoming committee that could use some extra hospitality training. "Please don't pull over," says my wife, Gemma, sort of reading my mind and sort of not. Anywhere else I might be suckered in by this feathered roadside anomaly, planked just off Highway 101 in the heart of Santa Barbara County, wine country. After a trafficy drive out of Los Angeles, not even the roadside charm of leggy landbirds can divert this weekend warrior mission, vanishing for two restorative nights at the Elisal Guest Ranch and Resort, a long-cherished hideaway with even deeper, if lower-key, western roots than all of those splashy vineyards sharing the same picture-perfect Central California coast valley. Entering the valley's bucolic, oak-sprinkled coastal foothills, home to the Danish-style tourist town of Solvang, over 120 wineries, an eternal marketing campaign as the place where the movie Sideways was shot, nearly 20 years ago already, and yes, ostriches and emus too, we're just a few miles in a short parallel universe away from our firmly targeted destination. Over the next 48 hours, we'll be checking our Type A tendencies at the gate to engage in one of the Elisal's most time-honored activities, lazing around with no concrete plan besides resting in a supremely peaceful and gorgeous spot, eating too much good food, sipping fine Santanese wine, and at some point, climbing onto a horse, because how could you not? Here. The word Elisal, I know from Googling, is Spanish for alder grove or alder tree, a birch family species that favors coasts and streams. That second sounds about right. The Elisal's land is bound by a river on the northeast and by a coastal mountain range on the southwest. Horses and cattle have been grazing on its pastoral palette, a former Chumash hunting ground, since the days of California's Spanish vaqueros. Generations of American ranchers and cowboys would follow, refining the property's pedigree in a Kentucky Derby-winning thoroughbred, 1925's Flying Ebony, raised in the very stables you still can saddle up at nearly a century later. The Elisal's next phase, as a rustic luxury guest ranch for urban escapees, would begin in 1946 and would see the property welcoming old Hollywood A-listers like five-time groom Clark Gable, he tied one of his knots in the Elisal Library, and Doris Day, a low-key regular, as well as generations of families from all over who can trace annual Elisal holidays back to the Eisenhower days. We have people who've been coming here since the 50s, says a chipper, silver-bearded, cowboy-hatted Elisal staff member named Ron, who ushers us into a lovely pine-paneled suite with high-peaked ceilings, wall-fulls of Western art, a large stone fireplace with Alan LeMay novels, and a complimentary bottle of local Syrah within easy reach. And, not the least bit accidentally, no phones or TVs. I've seen kids return here year after year after year, Ron says. First when they were 4 years old, and now they're finishing up college. So that's pretty neat, too. Ron is the guest ranch's affable night manager, though he's clearly just as personable and informative during the day. He's worn a whole lot of hats at this place over the last umpteen years, he tells us, and it seems pretty clear he's enjoyed donning all of them. This is just one of those very special spots, he says genuinely, before briefing us on a laundry list of offerings to keep us happily occupied here. Tennis, golf, biking, paddling, pickleball, fly fishing, riflery. We may go for a short hike in a little bit, I feel unnecessarily compelled to reassure Ron. And we've signed up for the breakfast ride before checkup. Good, 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 Ron says. You'll not want to miss the breakfast ride. That's a must. Now, if you'll allow, let me steer you toward a real nice walking trail. Ron points the way to a trailhead tucked behind the resort's manicured main grounds. It winds up a grassy hillside dotted with a few stray cows. If we're lucky, Ron says, we might even spot a mountain lion along the way. Don't be worried about running into one of them on the property, he then quickly assures us, gauging certain expressions. I've spotted only two of them here over the past 16 years. You'll never see them. Then he adds with a twinkle, but they always see us. Wandering through the resort's expansive grounds, which include 70-some luxury cottages and suites, tennis courts, a large swimming pool, spa facilities, a pair of 18-hole championship golf courses, a large spring-fed lake furnished with canoes and kayaks, and horse stables leading to 50 miles of backcountry riding trails across over 10,000 acres of coastal cow foothills, it's hard not to experience numerous déjà vu moments, even if you've only been here just once before. My first Elisal visit was years ago. I was attending one of the resort's popular culinary events, barbecue boot camp, and reporting on stuffing my face with Santa Maria-style chops and local vino. Today, walking past a large oval of grass on the main resort grounds near the pool, en route to our late afternoon hike, my temporal lobe's total recall button suddenly lights up. There they all are, a bunch of gleeful young siblings and cousins tearing around the lawn with all the parents and grandparents contentedly looking on from chairs outside their cottage doors, swirling wine, and generally relishing life. It's precisely the scene I remember seeing the last time I crossed this lawn years ago. No doubt, in a few decades, these kids tumbling on the grass will be clinking their own glasses of Chardonnay while watching the next tireless group of Elisal youth navigate the green oval like many human stock cars. Deja vu will shadow me around at every turn here, on recollected hiking trails that are just as I'd left them, in the stately ranch room, a former cattleman's grub quarters, full of chatty families in sport coats and dinner attire, feasting by a crackling fire, on horseback in the property's vivid backcountry, appearing out of the dawn mist like a favorite old movie scene. Just down the road, a busy wine tourism hub occupies the same valley, but you'd never know it at this place, which is exactly as you remember it year after year after year. Our happy hour hike begins at a gate beside a cattle fence where a pair of cautionary signs advise guests entering the trail that rattlesnakes may be present and mountain lions are important members of the natural community. Never mind all that. The broad sloped trail winding upward under old oak branches, draped in strands of mossy lichen, is every bit as genial as it looks, with the promise of a sweet hilltop panorama up ahead. Choruses of chirping crickets fade in and out, punctuated by the occasional squawk of a scrub jay. The most fearsome silhouettes hiding in these trees will be painfully shy family of deer with ferociously torqued ears at the ready. None of these big benignities stop a couple who are approaching 20 years of marriage from blithely discussing which one of us would get eaten if a mountain lion did actually decide to formally introduce himself along the way. But that's totally on us. Half an hour later, we're standing in the anticipated vista point with the Santa Ynez Valley spread below us like a European dreamscape reimagined by breezy California. In the foreground, there's the Danish town of Solvang, with its Who's Kidding Who windmills and Copenhagen Drive, all reduced to dollhouse size from up here. Beyond that, Ireland-worthy emerald hills dotted in oaks, red-berried manzanita, and Mediterranean scrub roll for miles and miles, blending with vineyards and additional thumbnail-sized towns that could be at home in central France if you tossed in a few medieval castles. Beyond that are time-blunted mountains and eventually the sea. After our hike, we reverse whatever calories we burned with a rich fireside meal in the ranch room that includes a roasted lobster tail and my first ever chicken fried steak. There's a moment's hesitation when the dessert menu arrives. As much as we'd like to pretend otherwise, there's simply no room left in either of us right now for freshly baked cobbler and a piece of Alyssa's Yeehaw cake, chocolate cake with salted caramel, whipped cream, and a toffee crunch. "I can pack it up and you can take it back to the room to enjoy it a little later," suggests our server, solving the day's biggest problem that just like that. Two empty dessert plates, some Syrah by our own private log fire, a peaceful night's sleep and a large ranch-style buffet breakfast with a couple of strong cups of coffee later, we tear ourselves away from the resort the following morning to take a spin through wine country. Along the two-lane highways, an endless watercolor of green floats by, accented by familiar-sounding vineyard signs, Sunstone, Firestone, Brander, Buttonwood, and mild little towns with storybook names and interestingly varied vibes. In Solvang, we browse the quasi-quaint blocks of Scandinavian-ish shops where the valley's thickest tourist clusters chow down on puffy donut hole-style Danish pancakes, stock up at Ingeborg's Danish Chocolates, and purchase its Wine O'Clock t-shirts. 5 miles down the road, the no-nonsense cowboy town of Santa Ynez is a study in contrast with its giant feed store, local saloons, roadside hitching posts for horse traffic, and an easily overlooked Santa Ynez Valley Historical Society Museum and Parks Janeway Carriage House, where one of the finer collections of Western stagecoaches and horse-drawn vehicles hides in an unassuming bungalow. Another five-mile hop leads to the tiny onophile magnate of Los Olivos, packing a healthy supply of tasting rooms, art galleries, olive oil shops, and promising-looking bistros into its few mercantile blocks. Also here, the area's best one-stop cowboy emporium at the venerable Jedlicka's Western Ware and Saddlery, in business since the 1930s, with its rows of big-name boots, silver belt buckles, walls of horse tack, and my favorite new Wrangler work shirt. Soon enough, it's time to walk the green oval at dusk, past the laughing kids playing Daytona 500, to the ranch room for another lovely evening meal for two by the fire. Soon enough, it's also time to nod again gratefully when our deja vu server from last night offers to pack up our desserts to enjoy in our room a little later. On our final crisp morning, we are saddling up before the sun for the Alyssa's most unmissable rite of passage, the breakfast ride. Gathering at the resort's stables with clusters of bundled-up families, we're introduced to our horses, a Palomino for Gemma, and a character named Rocco for me, who sounds like he could be going home with a note today. Rocco can be a little cranky at times, our Wrangler guide casually warns. If he gets ornery, just remind him who's boss. In the dim, dewy pre-dawn, we ride off in small posses, promptly vanishing into the Alyssa's lovely, lively backyard. Big dark shapes, cows, stare back at us curiously from working pastures that will be home to over 14 head of cattle grazing here until late spring. Crows perch on fence posts, already complaining incessantly about the day. A coyote lopes by on stealth business, Somewhere in the distance, a wild turkey gobbles its brief sermon, and repeatedly, Rocco reminds me who's boss. Up we go into foggy green hills, furnished with towering trees, one of which houses a couple of bald eagles who've been together for nearly 20 years and have mated 100 babies, or thereabouts, our guide tells us. Somewhere down the back side of these hills, at a historic adobe near a thick grove of sycamores, a big country breakfast is being prepared for us by a doting staff. A hot oak campfire is being lit. A local guitarist is warming up with some sweet morning accompaniment. One more round of Blackbird, Take Me Home Country Roads, and Mamas Don't Let Your Babies Grow Up to Be Cowboys for the books. Who isn't looking forward to vividly remembering all of that the next time? Anson Mount. The esteemed actor and occasional CNI essayist reflects on the joys and heartbreaks of starring in Hell on Wheels 10 years after the series' debut. By Joe Layden. After a season-long trial run on Star Trek Discovery to earn his intergalactic bona fides, Anson Mount is ready to blast off again as Captain Christopher Pike, the pre-Kirk commander of the USS Enterprise, in Star Trek Strange New Worlds, the upcoming Paramount Plus series that continues and expands the mythos spawned more than a half century ago by writer-producer Gene Roddenberry. But even as he journeys to the far, far corners of the universe, Mount knows he will never travel far, in the minds of CNI readers and ardent fans at least, from the rugged earthscape of Hell on Wheels, the classic 2011 to 2016 TV series that found him perfectly cast as Cullen Bohannon, a Confederate Army veteran who evolved gradually and often reluctantly from a man obsessed with avenging the murders of his wife and son to a historical bit player intent on helping construct the Transcontinental Railroad. During a recent Zoom conversation from Toronto, the filming location for Strange New Worlds, Mount noted that the two series are not exactly worlds apart. It's the reason the first four words of every episode in the original Star Trek show are Space, the Final Frontier. Gene Roddenberry saw Star Trek as the natural extension of the wagon trains going west. And yeah, to him, it was a space western. Now it turns out he may very well have been wrong, that space may not be the final frontier. After the original series ended, we've gained deeper understanding of multidimensionality and the multiverse theory. But when I think about that, those ideas, I'm not disappointed, dejected, or feel put upon by the idea that there's even more to be discovered. I am naturally excited, and I think most other people are naturally excited by that. I think that there's something deeply human about that feeling, about that emotion, which is at the heart of not only what Roddenberry was trying to capture about our exploratory nature, but also is what drove the wagon trains west. My favorite Gene Roddenberry quote is, "Star Trek speaks to some basic needs, that there is a tomorrow." I think that there's something deeply human in our need to gather around the campfire and hear a story told together, which is why I think movie theaters will never go out of fashion. And it's equally human about those of us who need to turn around and walk out of the firelight to see what's out there in the darkness. To commemorate the 10th anniversary of the Hell on Wheels premiere episode, Mount readily agreed to flashback to the epic Western drama and share some treasured memories. Here are some highlights from our conversation, edited for brevity, clarity, and flow. You already had quite a diverse resume before Hell on Wheels, but there were no Westerns among your IMDb.com credits. Were you surprised when you were offered the role of Cullen Bohannon? Well, I'd been asking the universe for a Western for a couple of years, so I was like, oh, maybe this is the one. Maybe this is it. But then when I read the script, for me, the genre took a back seat to what the story clearly was about. It appeared to me, and turns out I was right, like it was the beginning of a long-form, coming-of-age story about a person with PTSD. At the same time, though, it had all the elements that you'd want an action drama to have. It was just one of the best pilots I've ever read, and I knew I wanted to do it immediately. Why do you think you were so eager to do a Western? I think part of it is just about every American boy and young American man wants to do a Western. It's our genre. I grew up a fan of Westerns. Sunday afternoon after church, it was either a double bill or two old Westerns from the 60s and 70s, or even earlier, or it was two martial arts films, or it was a Western and a martial arts film. And those two genres, they're very much alike. I remember the first time I spoke with you early in the run of Hell on Wheels, and even then you acknowledged that the show would not, could not, continue to follow Cullen down a vengeance trail indefinitely, and would move in a different direction. Can you recall the conference you had with the writers where you realized that would indeed happen? Yes, I honestly cannot remember who it was with, but there were a couple of different conversations. It was a sort of a realization in the formulation of season two that it was becoming a story about somebody that we'd never seen before. The story that had legs was the healing story. So if you keep chasing this guy for revenge, clearly Cullen has not taken anywhere near the first step towards healing. So they eventually did lay down the track work, no pun intended, to get out of that trap and get down a different road. In fact, there was a point where it appeared to you and Cullen simply forgot that his original intent was to track down the rogue Union soldiers who killed his wife and son at his plantation before he could make it home from the Civil War. Enough time has gone by that I think it's okay for me to tell you that the original idea that the writers did not share with anyone, and even then it was only shared with me and Common at the end of shooting season one, was to eventually have the revelation that the last man I was looking for was actually Elam Ferguson. That Elam, Common's character, had been forced into servitude in the way that he ended up in my house during the killing of my family, or something like that. I don't know exactly how it was being formulated, but the idea was that the man I was looking for was actually Elam. I remember responding to that idea, but I also remember Common being like, I don't know, man. And I was like, really? Why? And he was like, something about it just doesn't. And I was like, is it because you're worried about your character? And he was like, no, it's not about that. It just feels kind of obvious in hindsight. It feels like it's the juiciest possible idea. And I think he was right. And I think it was the right decision to abandon that idea at a certain point. Out of the many things that appealed to me about Hell on Wheels is the way characters were able to grow and change and evolve as the series progressed. And not just Cullen and Elam, but people like Cole Meany's Doc Durant. They became richer, deeper, more complex characters. And other characters who weren't intended to be regulars became regulars because they made such strong impressions. Like Don Norwood's Psalms was originally going to be on for only two or three episodes, but he just became a character that the writers wanted to write about. Well, it also has to do with the actor. The same thing was true with Chris Heyerdahl as the Swede. Originally, he was hired for that one episode, Immoral Mathematics, in season one. And they saw what he was doing the first day on set, and they're like, oh, we got to have more of this guy. So young actors reading this, let that be a lesson to you. If you can bring something to the table that makes the writers look better, then they will want to write more for you. Did you ever worry that you might not ever get another role as complex as Cullen Bohannon? Oh, I'm sure, because I'm getting older. I think it's bound to happen. I'm hoping that we can get Captain Pike to the point where he is as complex. I miss Hell on Wheels for a lot of reasons, but I know that if I was still doing it, obviously, I'd be sick of it by now. My life is more complex, but it's also richer. I'm about to become a father. Well, congratulations. You are about to start one of life's great adventures. Thank you. Yeah, I definitely am. When we finished Hell on Wheels, the best and simplest way I could describe it to people when they would ask me about it was, that's a chapter. That's a chapter. This is the first time in my life where I've seen something coming down the road, and I can say definitely without question, this is the next chapter. Well, I guess you could say Cullen Bohannon was the right role at the right time for you. And now is the right time for you to be a father. Yeah, I think so. And I think it's fortuitous that I'm playing Pike at the same time. There's something fatherly about that figure that I'm trying to explore. But you know what? That reminds me of something. You asked me a while ago to come up with my list of favorite Hell on Wheels episodes. And I've been trying to figure out if the reason that I did not do what you asked is because I've been ridiculously busy finishing the season of Strange New Wheels, or because I didn't want to. And I think that the honest answer is that I didn't want to, because it's just never felt right. Because it's like asking me to pick my favorite child. And I know it's just about such a cliche thing to say, but it's true because I love the entire series. We poured our hearts out in every episode, and it would feel almost wrong to say, these are my favorites. But what I did do is start thinking about what are the moments of filming that pop up in my memory. And the first one that just popped up, and what we were just talking about reminded me of this, is Revelations, Episode 7 in Season 1. When Elam and I are on the run and we're around a campfire and he's turned his back to me and I'm half drunk talking about discovering the body of my son. And I have this really long story I tell. And we were feeling really good about where the scene had gotten to. And between setups, we just stayed around the fire because it was the most comfortable place in that field. And Common rolled over and looked at me across the fire and said, "That's good work, man." I said, "I'm just talking about my father's death." In my mind as an actor, the words are the words. But in my mind as an actor, what I was doing was thinking about my father's death. And I told Common that. And Common got really still and looked at me. He said, "I knew that's what you were doing. How did I know that's what you were doing?" I said, "I don't know, man." But from then on, we always talked about that. And it was a very odd moment for us, but it was the moment that allowed him and I to realize that we were gelling as well as two actors could gel. And it's a precious memory, definitely. I fully realize that you and Common are actors and you're professionals and you're only playing roles, blah, blah, blah. But how difficult was it for you to film that scene in Season 4 in Elam Ferguson when Cullen had to shoot Elam to put him out of his misery? Well, it reminds me of this story that director David Von Anken always talked about when he was working with Pierce Brosnan on the Western Seraphim Falls. One day they were getting ready to shoot and he was watching Pierce making a notation on his script. And he kept writing these initials next to the certain lines, N-A-R, N-A-R. And David asked, "What does N-A-R mean?" And Pierce said, "Well, in this scene, my character is cold. I'm cold. He's afraid for his life. This is a very dangerous place. I'm afraid for my life. So, no acting required." And it was sort of like that on Elam Ferguson. I didn't really have to work too hard to figure out the as-ifs in those scenes because we were all mourning the loss of Common. It was clear he had other things he wanted to go on and do, and he had our blessings, but it was still a death. And later, I remember very clearly showing up to do the burial scene, which was just me and a box. It's one of those moments when you're like, I know what I have to do. I have no idea how I'm going to do it. And when director Rod Lurie and I talked about it, I was like, can you just let the camera roll? I think I'm going to have one shot at this. And that's the shot that ended up in the episode, that last pull away. What I figured out about the scene was, well, you learn to listen to the little birdie as an artist. And that day, the little birdie said, he has to throw up. Now, as a young actor, I could have ignored the little birdie because that's nonsense. But since then, I've learned you've got to listen to the muse, right? So I was just like, oh, of course. Of course, Cullen finally was able to make a redeeming human contact with May, played by Angela Shaw. And in the final episode, we see him following her to China in hopes of a reconciliation. Have you ever thought of doing something similar to what the producers of Deadwood did and film a TV movie to wrap up the Hell on Wheels narrative? I don't know. It doesn't feel right. I think Cullen has earned his rest. I'm not sure I would want to try and tack anything on to what we did because it's of a particular place in our lives and in television. Well, that's probably a good idea, because if you ask 50 different fans of the show what finally happened to you and me and everyone else on the Hell of Wheels universe, you'd probably have 50 different sets of theories on wishes or hopes. And you know what? We're all right. Exactly. We can never top what's in people's imagination. For what it's worth, I don't really know what happened. I think each one of those theories is true. And besides, it's not about me, it's about our audience, and it's about Cullen. Yeah, I'm content for Cullen to go on living in the multiverse.
Hello, this is Michael. I'm reading from True West, November 2021 edition. Sooners and Boomers by Mike Kopic. The land run of 1891 was one of the most remarkable events in Western history. One needs to understand that Oklahoma is an instant land. There are four states younger than Oklahoma: Arizona, New Mexico, Alaska, and Hawaii. But they existed in name and place long before Oklahoma was conceived in 1890. Some 20,000 people stood in the sun along a line in what would become central Oklahoma on September 22, 1891, waiting for a signal to rush in and lay claim to a farm or a town lot. More than 900,000 acres were to be opened up. 6,097 homesteads, each one 160 acres, on a first-come basis. In less than 24 hours, they would have towns built, schools established, and farms marked off. Many of the settlers had made the first land run into central Oklahoma's unassigned lands in 1889, where 50,000 people had rushed in to stake their claim. Those who went early were called Sooners. Among the many settlers who followed the rules were former Boomers, who had spent years promoting the settlement of the unassigned lands. Some had gone bust and now seemed to be given a second chance with this land run. Many of the participants were in their 40s now. As young adults, they had sought their fortunes in Kansas or Texas or Nebraska and failed. The sheriff of Kingfisher County in the unassigned lands in 1890 estimated a third of the population needed to be on relief. The Oklahoma Territory was created from the unassigned lands only on May 2, 1890. The territory was to grow by adding on new lands that had been Indian reservations or in dispute with Texas. To the east, the five civilized tribes, the Cherokee Nation, the Creek Nation, the Seminole Nation, the Choctaw Nation, and the Chickasaw Nation, were designated by Congress as the new Indian Territory, along with a grouping of eight exceedingly small reservations in the far northeastern corner of what later would become the state of Oklahoma. A year earlier, the 86-member Iowa tribe sold 221,528 acres to the federal government at 28 cents an acre, keeping 80 acres for each member of the tribe. The Sac and Fox sold 391,189 acres to the government at $1.23 an acre, keeping 160 acres for each tribal member. The citizen band Potawatomi and the absentee Shawnee took 1,498 allotments and 563 allotments, respectively, with each allotment being 160 acres, and sold the remaining 325,000 acres to the government at 69 cents an acre. The federal government then turned around and sold the land to those rushing in at $1.25 an acre. The tribes later took the government agents to court and won on the charge of profiteering. One of the items that was to be created instantly was local government. The federal government wanted to avoid the problems that arose when it awarded town sites in the unassigned lands during the first land run. Those who had wanted to start businesses in the new territorial capital of Guthrie became so argumentative that four separate downtown Guthries were formed during the first month of its existence. Oklahoma City was worse. The Seminole Land Company hid would-be settlers in the woods before the land run. When the time came, they emerged from the brush before legal homesteaders arrived and claimed city lots for the land company. The land company had also sent in gunfighters to guard these city lots from honest homesteaders taking part in the land run. An effort was made to form a coalition government between the homesteaders and these company men in Oklahoma City, but it broke down into a massive fist fight. To prevent this from happening again at the two county seat locations of Chandler and Tecumseh, the federal government decided lots there would be handed out at a later date after the rush had calmed down. As September 22nd approached, thousands gathered at Guthrie, Oklahoma City, and Norman for the run. Between Guthrie and the Iowa tribal boundary was the all-black community of Langston, founded a year before. The night of September 21st, some 30 blacks arrived with Winchesters, marched into the camps of the would-be homesteaders. They wanted to make it clear to the white settlers their lands were not open to the claimants. They were willing to shoot to kill if they had to. Once they felt their message was understood, the 30 left. During the land run the next day, no trouble took place regarding Langston. Those participating in the land run were to drive their wooden stake into the land they wanted. Then they would look for a pile of rocks. Federal surveyors had surveyed and marked out allotments in a checkerboard fashion across former reservation lands. The surveyors wrote down the meridian line coordinates of the allotment sections, which served as legal descriptions for land deeds. Then they piled up rocks, attaching the information so settlers could find it. After a settler staked his claim and found the closest pile of rocks to write down a legal description, the claimant had to go back to the land office in either Guthrie or Oklahoma City to file the claim, often standing in long lines for hours. The morning of September 22nd, two companies of U.S. troops, as well as U.S. Marshals, enforced the line that settlers were not to cross until they heard the signal. Among the settlers were 1,500 African Americans concentrated around Langston for the run. Single women were also making the run. Maggie Smith from the Guthrie area secured 160 acres, while Dosky Simmons won a claim along the Deep Fork River. Two young women from Oklahoma City stood with their toes touching the line. When the gun sounded, the women simply stepped across the line, staking their claims right there. The run into the planned county of Texumseh for the future Potawatomi County had to be delayed because the surveyors were not finished with their work. That rush began at high noon on September 23rd. There was only one casualty. When a Dr. Roundtree jumped off his horse to stake a town lot, he was trampled to death by the rider behind him. The final run took place September 28th. as 5,000 people sought to be first to claim one of the 2,208 town lots in the future town of Chandler, the planned county seat for Lincoln County. Among the racers was a woman, Nanita Daisy. The federal government had staged these runs far too late for settlers to get in a major crop to sustain themselves. Indeed, the only major crop this late in the season they could grow was turnips. Through the winter months, homesteaders in these new lands ate boiled turnips, baked turnips, mashed turnips, and fried turnips 3 times a day. They even fed turnips to their cattle as a winter feed. Banks were established and proved unique. Unlike other banks across the country, they had no depositors, for the homesteaders had spent most of their money for supplies to make the run. Instead, these early banks transformed into land speculation firms and dealers in horses. When they did make cash loans, the interest was at 7%. Surprisingly, the real economic lifesavers for these new settlers were the railroads. The railroads loaned out seed at cost to the new farmers with the loans to be paid back in wheat. The railroads also provided agricultural experts to work with the farmers planting turkey red wheat from Russia instead of the then traditional soft-shelled wheat. The railroads' gamble paid off. Over 95% of the farmers paid their loans off to the railroads in full. The new towns began to prosper. Chandler became the intersection of two railroads. A flour mill, a cotton gin, and a brick plant opened. A cotton oil company employed 50 people. Chandler's cattle pens were busy, and fruit packing sheds were full. Then, 6 years after the land run, the town was leveled by a massive tornado, which killed 14 people and flattened town structures. The only building untouched was the Presbyterian Church. There was also the problem of the whiskey towns along the new land's border with the Indian Territory. The Indian Territory was dry, alcohol prohibited, while the new Oklahoma Territory was wet. Saloons sprang up right along the border to satisfy the thirst of the Native Americans and the more than 100,000 whites living in the Indian Territory. D.N. Beatty opened the first saloon, the Black Dog Saloon, a few days after the land run along the border with the Indian Territory. Soon, some 62 saloons and 3 distilleries popped up along the territorial border, as did towns like Corner, Keokuk Falls, and Violet Springs, which grew up around these saloons. Shootouts between rival saloons and bartenders became common. A stagecoach driver shouted at his passengers as he drove into Keokuk Falls, "Stop 20 minutes and see a man killed." "Pistols were always going off in all directions," said bartender Bud Ellison. "It sounded like a year-round 4th of July celebration." These whiskey towns continued until 1907, when the Oklahoma Territory was forced to merge with the Indian Territory to enter the Union as the Dry State of Oklahoma. By then, most of the would-be hopeful farmers of the land run had become tenant farmers, as had most farmers in southern and eastern Oklahoma. 2 years after these land runs, the largest land run of them all saw 100,000 people rush onto 2 million acres in northwest Oklahoma to create 40,000 homesteads in 1893. Among those galloping into the Cherokee outlet was my great-grandfather, Ernest Buckminster, who obtained a farm along Turkey Creek after brief gunplay with a rival claimant. Mike Kopik was born and raised in western Oklahoma, and after graduating from Phillips University in Enid, has lived off and on in Alaska since 1985. A former newspaper editor, he is currently historical interpreter at Denali National Park.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.